Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network, this is Terrible Tommy. Tom Metzger right here in the bunker, right here in north central Indiana, way out here in the woods. Yeah, on the 14th, 13th, Friday the 13th, and a full moon, boys and girls. That's very lucky for Aryans. Bad luck for other people. But if you're out there on the highway tonight with your sweetie pie going to the dance, you better watch out because there are crazies out there, man. And the rumor is that the black boys go crazy, man, when the moon is full. And so we hope we don't see too many of them around because we might have to call up the reserves, yeah. But this is Freya's Day, and we got a little song here. And this is dedicated not only to the girls, but old Tommy getting out of the right wing a few years ago. We need to celebrate that once in a while. And the question is, what is I? Well, I know I'm not a right winger anymore. I'm not an extreme right winger either. And I don't want to be just a leftist, so Stray Dog says maybe we ought to be extreme leftist. Nobody wants that spot. Got to have a spot on the spectrum. So we dedicate this song to the right wing and all the boys going to miss us over there. Yeah.
It don't hurt anymore. All my teardrops are dry. Floor with that burning inside, just to think it could be, time has opened the door, and at last I am free. I don't hurt anymore. To deny I wanted to die the day you said we were through, but now that I find you're out of my mind, I can't believe that it's true. I've forgotten somehow that I cared so before. Wonderful now, I don't hurt
that song, especially for me and all the girls and the jilted guys. That's the song I played for a week, the time that Dr. Edward Fields of the National States Rights Party, about, 15, 20 years ago, said, Tom Metzger, you're no longer in the right wing. And I said, Oh, come on, Dr. Field. He sent me a letter, as I recall. And I said, well, you can't fire me because I already quit. Anyhow, that song fits it perfectly. I don't hurt anymore. I'm out of the right wing. You got problems over there? Don't call me. You got to change your way of living, man. That also goes out to the ladies out there. I think a lot of ladies like Hank Snow. I know. He's an old guy. He's Canadian and so forth and so on. But I think there's still room for the good old country music, not this Jew York country that they play now. And it is. In fact, it got a lot of Jews singing country. Well, I don't care, but at least they could sing old country. Now, there's a guy down in Texas. He ran for governor. He's a Jew and got a southern accent and has a hillbilly band and the whole bit. Well, I think I could get along with him as long as he didn't start all that stuff up. You know what I mean. Well, we filled them out and sent them out this morning. 4 money orders to 4 POWs. So they'll probably get those in a few days, maybe a week or so, and not a tremendous amount of money. We usually send them $25 at a time, so. But they're always grateful to get it, because I don't think hardly anybody else ever gives them any money. You know what I mean? As far as these groups and stuff, no, I don't think. I got a call from Marty Cox, who's an old-time guy I've known for years, ever since he was a teenager. And when he got his, went from punk rock into skinhead music and had a band and a whole bit. Well, he's been having a real bad time with his heart, and finally he says they've put him on the list for a new heart. And that's great. That's great. But he said that heart going to cost $1 million. $1 million. He said, could you help me raise some money? I said, well, you know, most of the people, Marty, you know, are right-wingers. And did you ever try to get money out of the right wing? You got to be something like Plastic Man if you want to get money out of the right wing. You know, so I said, well, I'll send you a little bit, but I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to do much for that heart. But our best wishes go along with you, and we hope that happens pretty quick. And that'd be good. And maybe he can get back on the bandstand. Well, it looks like my insurgent friends are about to take Baghdad. I think it's cool, you know. Nobody else wants to associate with Tommy's insurgency, so we might as well throw in with the rest of the insurgents around the world. Yeah! That Maliki over there, that puppet president we put in there, of course. If you don't know by now, the Iraq War was pure, bare, raw aggression by the little son of a bitch that's hiding out down there in Texas. God, I hate that George Bush Jr. But don't anybody make a martyr out of the son of a bitch. I want to see him on trial, man. I want to see him on trial. Him and Cheney and Wolfowitz and all them bastards. They just, you know, and American people have no excuse. They went rah, rah, rah. Well, so they think some Arabs hit the World Trade Center. Well, none of them were Iraqis. None of them were Afghanistans, even if they pulled off the whole job, which a lot of people don't think they did. So that gives you somehow some kind of a crazy right to invade and occupy their country and kill hundreds of thousands of people. So, you know, like I said yesterday, the population, whether white or what, that went along with all that bullshit's just as criminal, almost as criminal as the guys that were in on it, the leaders of it, you know. So I said a long time ago, I said, well, once it's over and the smoke clears, the Iraqi people, whether they're Islamic or Taliban or whatever the hell they are going to retake their country. They're going to fight each other just like we have to fight each other here, like we did in the Civil War. We fought each other. So they're going to fight each other, but they're going to take it. Maliki's nothing but a stooge. He wouldn't make a third-rate ice cream salesman in Manhattan. And that's all he ever was. He didn't have that much support of the people. And these guys, they say, you know, you guys out there, you'd never go up, you could never do anything against the government because they got all these weapons and airplanes and all that shit. But look at these guys over there, all these guys we trained. The United States trained these guys and gave all these weapons, and you guys are going to be defending the Iraqi state. And you see what they're doing? They're throwing down our weapons and running away. They're not going to try to defend that U.S.-backed Maliki sitting there in his big building there, his headquarters. So I don't give a shit. I mean, you know, and in fact, if the whole Taliban or whatever takes over in the whole Middle East, it'll just force, hopefully, it'll force people in this country to turn to other forms of energy. I mean, just if we're fighting everywhere about oil, so it's going to hurt a little in the beginning. You're going to have to bite the bullet and go for it, and go to solar, and go to wind, and go to other things. There's other things they can do, and so I don't care. And good luck, insurgents. You know, take the capital. Take Baghdad. And give the finger to old Uncle Jew Sammy. It's all right with me, as long as you don't come in over here playing your games with me. Over there, hey, you're in charge. You're in charge. I mean, I like it when the U.S. military-industrial complex gets their ass kicked, because they're the same ones that would kick our ass internally. Whatever they do externally, they will do here in this country if we give them any trouble. So wherever they're getting their ass kicked, it's all right with me. I wouldn't raise any objections. Let them get their ass kicked. And the guys are going to go over there. If you're going to volunteer to go over there as hitmen for the corporations, if you're dumb and stupid and haven't studied anything about it, I'm sorry for you, because you're going to lose your arms and legs and stuff like that. And of course, that makes a lot of CEOs pretty wealthy around here, because we've got two or three of the biggest companies, artificial limb companies in the world right here, and they like these wars, man, because all these guys and getting their arms and legs and everything blown off. Well, they're making money hand over fist, and now Goldman Sachs is in on the deal. They're combining companies, and they're really going to town. But you can't talk to these people, and I'll tell you, I used to belong to the American Legion. I resigned because of their inability or refusal to confront the depleted uranium poison problem that's not only overseas but all around on these bases all over the country where they're using depleted uranium ammunition. We don't know really yet how much that is around, and that's terrible stuff. Terrible stuff. In fact, a lot of these guys that go ape shit that are military guys, I'm suspicious that they've got depleted uranium poisoning, because that's one of the things that it causes. And whether they got it over there, whether they get it here on the base, so I don't know. Anyhow, hopefully the boys will take Baghdad by the weekend. Fuck you, military-industrial complex, Republican Party. Fuck you. Well, 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 what's going on here? I see Argentina is allowing a neo-Nazi group to be approved as a political party, an ultra-nationalist organization. Not far right, far right. This is an ultra-nationalist organization led by, I'm not even going to try that, last name, Biondini, an accused neo-Nazi, won legal approval as a registered political party. Buenos Aires Judge Ariel Lijo granted the approval for Bandera Vecino, or local flag, on Wednesday. The party, which is expected to participate in the 2015 presidential elections, had signed up the required 4,000 members. The Jewish political umbrella, DAIA, said Biondini has publicly and repeatedly supported the figure of Adolf Hitler and Nazism. DAIA reiterates its position to not legitimize as a political party those who justify hatred and encourage violence against the Jew community and others in our country. Don't you realize only Jews can advocate violence against other people? In 1988, Biondini led Chants of Death to Traitors, Cowards, and Jews at a gathering of extreme right demonstrators in Buenos Aires. At the time, Biondini's group was called the National Alert, reminiscent of the cry, Germany Awake. 3 years later, a judge quashed his group's request to register as the Workers' National Socialist Party. Why would they do that? That's what we want. And use the swastika as a symbol. In 2011 elections, Biondini's Social Alternative Party garnered just 0.19% of the vote. His previous party, New Triumph, was banned by Argentina's supreme swine on 2009. Well, there you go. He's got a long way to go, but he's only got 0.19 of the votes. Electorate, he's got to get up to at least 20 before they shut him down. Yeah, right. Well, I have no way of knowing whether this is racial or not, except the person, the driver of the repossessing truck, was black, mulatto, a 23-year-old Maryland man who had taken a job repossessing cars so he could buy a wedding ring for his new wife, died over the weekend after a Virginia man shot him twice. I don't think it's too safe to be a repo man, because I've seen a lot of that stuff on television. Oh, they go out there to pick up a car, and it's like taking your life in your hands. Fuckwire now reported that Junior Jordan Montero died while he was attempting to repossess a 10-year-old pickup truck in Fauquier County early Friday morning. When Sergeant Daryl Shores arrived on the scene, 53-year-old truck owner Carol Edward Gregg Jr. told the deputy that the shooting had been just an accident. Oh, I see. Let's see what kind of accident it was. Quote, he's in there dead, unquote, Greg said, pointing to the ditch. Quote, I shot him, unquote, he allegedly explained. Quote, I shot, fell, and shot again. It was an accident, unquote. Divers attempted to rescue Montero from the water-filled ditch where his tow truck ended up, but it was too late. Greg told officers that it should be against the law for vehicles to be repossessed in the middle of the night. Well, I think that's true. According to WRC, Montero had taken a job as repo man to provide a better life for his wife, Mayense Molina, and her son. He wanted to buy her a wedding ring and to move out of his in-laws' home into a home of their own where they could have 15 non-white kids. Montero had only been a repo man for 2 weeks. His family planned to bury his body in the Dominican Republic, where he was born. Well, that's one way to deport him. Greg was facing charges of second-degree murder. He requested a court-appointed attorney at a hearing on Friday, saying that he could not afford to pay for one himself. Well, let's see here. Where am I at? Watch the video below with WRC broadcast on June the 12th. Okay, let's see what this is all about.
Dalvin is back. We are up
in a tow truck just trying to support his family tonight.
The victim is from the Dominican Republic, but had lived for many years in Maryland. He was shot killed while doing his job in Fauquier County, Virginia. News 4's Pat Collins spoke with his family.
2 weeks ago, Jordan Montero got a job repossessing vehicles so he could make more money and buy his wife a wedding ring and a home of their own. Last Friday, Jordan Montero shot and killed as he tried to repossess a truck in Virginia. Jordan Montero, he was 23 years old. His family crushed by what happened.
I don't have words to explain how bad it is. I don't have words to say how my family is suffering right now.
Mayenzi Molina and Jordan Montero were married just last August. She said she warned him about the dangers of that job.
He knew it was dangerous.
Yes.
But he wanted to
provide.
And now this.
It happened in the dark hours of the morning last Friday on Condy Road in Fauquier County, Virginia. Jordan Montero went to repossess a 10-year-old pickup truck. Police say the owner of the truck came out shooting. The tow truck in the pickup ended up in a water-filled ditch. Police had to use divers to go and try to save Jordan Montero. But there was nothing they could do. Police identified the shooter as 53-year-old Carol Gregg.
Police say that Gregg confessed with these words. I shot him. I shot, fell, and shot again. He said it was an accident.
Please, I beg everybody to listen to me right now. We need to bring this to justice.
Jordan Montero. His wife says he was a man of big dreams that he wanted to study in one day.
Well, it was a white guy that shot him. he's in big trouble. I think we got another one of those situations arising up here where all the civil wrongs people can run in there and muddy the water. Yeah. Well, we'll see. I guess he'd have been better off to stay in the Dominican Republic along with thousands more of those people that have come up here. He would have been fairly safe down there, Dominican Republic, because they don't have as many cars. They got a lot of cars, but not as many. Repo man, you takes what you get, man. You takes what you get. Play Russian roulette every time you go out there. Now, you remember this big mouth son of a bitch, McCain? Yeah. I think I've got my volume up a little bit too high here. Yeah, old McCain's at it again. He's at it again. Remember, he was on the front rows cheering for the invasion of Iraq. Now let's see what he's got to say. What a rat.
Time to regulate. John McCain is going to tell us what we did wrong in Iraq and what should have happened instead. Now, remember, John McCain, the biggest cheerleader for the Iraq war in the first place. Okay, John, tell us what went wrong.
On December 14th, the day that the president in triumph visited Fort Bragg to mark the end, in his view, the end of the Iraq war, I said, over 4,000 brave young Americans gave their lives in this conflict. I pray that their sacrifice is not in vain. Unfortunately, it is clear that this decision of a complete pullout of United States troops from Iraq was dictated by politics and not our national security interests. I believe that history will judge this president's leadership with the scorn and disdain that it deserves.
You know, no. You know who deserves scorn and disdain? Your sorry ass, who wanted to go to Iraq in the first place. You want to go back into Iraq? You think that's a genius move? Oh, we shouldn't have left Iraq in the first place. How long are we going to stay there? 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. They don't want to be together. The Sunnis, the Shia, and the Kurds, they don't want to be together. That's why we shouldn't have gone in there and destabilized them and destabilized the whole Middle East. But this idiot thinks the lesson was we didn't stay long enough. We didn't create enough of a war, a big enough of a war in the Middle East. Yeah, brilliant. And more quotes from this, honestly, moron, this war hawk whose bloodlust cannot be satisfied. The first thing is to get rid of this national security team, he says, which has been a total failure. They called back in people who succeeded in Iraq, like General Petraeus, General Mattis, many of the other leaders, General Kane, who's the architect of the surge. So, okay, yeah, you want to go back to the surge. Okay, so you want to fire the entire national security team for President Obama? Here's who should be fired. You! You're the one who made us go to Iraq in the first place! How's that working out, Johnny? Do you really think, oh man, that Iraq war, we nailed it? No, the only problem is, if we just stayed decades longer. Now, you see, John, if it had worked and you had the wonderful democracy that you wanted and you told us we were going to get in Iraq, and by the way, you said it was going to be easy. Does it look easy, John McCain? Does it look easy? Okay, now if we'd gotten that, why would we need to send troops back in? Well, shouldn't they be living together in perfect harmony? Shouldn't they be throwing roses at our feet and each other's feet? Looks like they hate each other, that we have started a civil war that is impossible to put out. But no, he doesn't get that. He thinks, oh, no. Since we didn't have more war, everybody who was against more war should be fired. So you should be fired. He says it's the greatest threat since the Cold War. By the way, what he didn't mention there, the end of the sentence is brought to you by John McCain and his buddies. We didn't have to have that threat. We were fighting Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda was in Afghanistan. They were not in Iraq. Iraq didn't do 9/11. Al-Qaeda was not in Iraq. What happened? Since we started the Civil War, Al-Qaeda thought, hey, great. The Americans came in here like sitting ducks into the Middle East. We couldn't, like, we hit them once. But the idea that they would bring in troops here so we could hit them over and over again, great. Then they come into Iraq. And then things got so radical, so extreme. The Islamic State in Iraq and Syria right now is so radical, Al-Qaeda rejects them. Well played, John McCain. You want more of that? He says, all of this could have been avoided. Well, you got that goddamn right. It could have been avoided if we didn't go into Iraq in the first place. The gall on this guy to complain about what's happening in Iraq now. He says, it's been a colossal failure of the American security policy. Once again, you're right, John McCain. That colossal failure is you. And Don Rumsfeld, and Dick Cheney, and George W. Bush, you guys are all an embarrassment to the United States of America, and we should never listen to your stupid advice on foreign policy ever again. He says, I hope the president would take some of the lessons of what we're seeing happening in Iraq and not repeat them in Afghanistan. You understand? After all this, John McCain says, the answer is more war. I forgot the question. I forgot why we went into Iraq. I forgot why we went into Afghanistan. But I know the answer is more war. So don't make the mistake of pulling out of Afghanistan. Double down. Stay there for another couple of decades. Give me more war. That's what John McCain said. John McCain is a miserable and, in his words, colossal failure. The only thing we did wrong was to listen to war hawks like him in the first place.
Well, now this David Brat, who won that election back east, is in big trouble. Virginia's House Republican primary victor, David Brat, has been caught up in a storm over an innocuous essay he wrote 3 years ago warning that Adolf Hitler's rise could happen all over again. Wall Street Journal writer Reed Epstein has been attacked by Breitbart reporter John Nolte for his attempts to manufacture from thin air a political controversy involving Brat, who caused a shocking upset this week by defeating House Majority Jew leader Eric Cantor in the GOP primary. In 2011, Brat had written a 13-page essay in an issue of Interpretation, the Journal of Bible and Theology, another one. which included comments about Hitler's Nazi Germany. In a column titled David Bratt's Writings, Hitler's Rise Could Happen Again, Epstein said. It is a reference to Hitler's Germany that is likely to turn heads during Mr. Bratt's first full day as a Tea Party star. Well, it's logical. Of course a Hitler-type thing could rise. I think we've had several. But Breitbart's Nolte noted that Bratt's comments are actually anti-Hitler, while reproducing the part of Bratt's essay that included mention of the Third Reich leader. Yeah. Bratt wrote, quote, "Capitalism is here to stay, and we need a church model that corresponds to that reality." Whoa. We're out of the frying pan into the fire, baby. Read Nietzsche. Nietzsche diagnoses the weak modern Christian democratic man was spot on. Jesus was a man. Jesus actually made people better. Then came the Christians. What happened? What went wrong? We appear to be a bit passive. Hitler came along. He did not meet with unified resistance. Well, he had quite a bit of resistance, as I recall, in my studies. I have the sinking feeling that it could all happen again quite easily. The church should rise up higher than Nietzsche could see and prove him wrong. If we all did the right thing and had the guts to spread the word of baby Jesus, we would not need the government to backstop every action we take, unquote. Nolte called Bratt's reasoning factually accurate and articulate. While condemning Epstein's comments, especially his non sequitur connecting Bratt's essay to the fact that Cantor is the only Jewish Republican in Congress, Nolte added 13 full pages, one warning about how we have not to repeat the mistakes made by Germany possible. And from that, Epstein quips up a word soup about Hitler, rise again, Tea Party, defeat Jewish. Well, anyhow, I guess he knows to keep his mouth shut, but he's another Christ insanity guy that's in there now. I don't think he's going to be a bit better than old Jew Cantor. Well, some sad news out of Canada. Canadian patriot and schoolteacher Jim Keenstra was prosecuted in 1983 under Canada's then-existing hate statute for claiming the so-called Holocaust was exaggerated. He subsequently became the first nationally vilified martyr for Canadian freedom of speech in Canada. That claim was subsequently substantiated when the World Jewish Congress, in conjunction with the Auschwitz State Museum in Poland, lowered the number of gassing victims at Auschwitz from 4 million to 1 million in 1990. So for any apologist who says the numbers don't matter, it did to Patriot Jim Keenstra, who lost his job as a teacher and the mayor of the town he lived in and was continually vilified and slandered by the national media ever since. As a result, he was defunctionalized socially, politically, and economically, like heretics of the Middle Ages who denied the earth was the center of the universe. You don't deny the state religion of the West and get away with it. The only difference between then and now is that they've found a more civilized way of burning people at the stake. There were other Canadian martyrs before Jim. People like my good friend and mentor, John Ross Taylor from Toronto, who spent a year in jail in the late 70s for a telephone message talking about the Jews and their machinations. But Jim Keenstra was the first to really go national in a big way. Well, remember one thing, too. I met John Ross Taylor several times. He was interned during World War II because of his anti-war position. So he had a long career of being hassled. I guess they figured at the time that Canadians had been dumbed down enough that it didn't really matter what kind of outrage was perpetrated against traditional freedoms. notwithstanding that those freedoms went all the way back to the Magna Carta, and they were right. In fact, the Keister case was the first one, to my knowledge, where a Canadian judge, in his final address to the jury, stated, quote, "The truth is not the issue in this case," unquote. If the truth is not an issue in a court of law, then what the hell is? I still haven't figured out that one out, and obviously Jim Keister hadn't either. The RCMP even stationed armed snipers on the roof of the Red Deer, Alberta courthouse when Jim was being tried. Canada, it seemed, must be protected against heretics at all costs. This is a common thing to muddy the water and the jury see all this stuff. They did it to me in Portland, Oregon, in a civil trial. They had guys with machine guns on the roof. They papered over all the windows in the courtroom. They had metal detectors in the hall, and we had to go into the courtroom. We had to go right past the jurors who were watching them shake us down, pat us down, put us through the metal detector. That's a standard policy of the system to make you look like you're a horrible, dangerous person. Jim Keegstra was a friend and patriot who went out like a man. He will be sadly missed. That was from an old contact of mine, Terry Long. And I never got to meet Jim Keegstra. I've met most of the guys up there over the years, but I never got to meet him. He was way out there in the West in a small town. Red Deer, I think it was, yeah. Anyhow, that's the way it goes. He fought till the very end, and that's the way to do it. Well, the Jew boys are upset now with Nike, and of course all the fellow travelers of the Jews. Time to the 2014 World Cup, Nike has produced an animated video that tells the story of an evil plot to drain all life out of soccer with a team of dark-haired, prominent-nosed soccer robots. What's unsettling to some is that the logo for this inhuman team resembles the Star of David and the symbol of Israel and the Jewish people. In one shot, where the team's symbol is seen on a jumbo stadium screen, the resemblance is particularly strong. On close inspection, the six-pointed star-like symbol on the players' uniforms seems to be made up of six soccer balls, or footballs as they're known abroad, with rectangular caps. Jewish groups have raised objections with Nike, as have members of the Knesset, Israel's parliament. The Times of Israel reported that Knesset member Shimon Ohayon, chairman of the Knesset caucus to combat anti-Judaism, accused Nike of using, quote, using Jewish symbols in sports products to transmit anti-Jew messages. Wow. Nike's response, quote, "The logo shown on the clone's player uniform and on the advertising boards in the last game film is a logo of a football. Any resemblance to any other symbol or image within the campaign is entirely coincidental and unintentional," unquote. "We respect all religions, and the image was in no way designed to cause any offense," unquote. The statement continued. Well, now that they've made it into an anti-Semitic thing, that's great, because all the controversy, they say Jews are smart. I don't think they're that smart, because instead of letting something die quietly, they wade right in and make it bigger than ever. So now this is going to go around the world, and everybody's going to see it for what they want to see it. And all the anti-Jews out there are going to see it for what they like. It's a Star of David. It's happening everywhere. I saw a Star of David in my neighbor's pasture out here in a cow paddy a cow poop patty. I saw a Star of David in there, and I told my neighbor, I said, you got to quit being so anti-semantic. Quit that being anti-semantic. Well, I just took a little break and was listening to testimony by the head of the FBI before congressional people. And, you know, mostly gobbledygook, but interestingly enough, they raised their budget tremendously, just like they do for the military-industrial complex. I'll play this little bit back to you, his opening statement to these congressmen. Incidentally, he just came back, he said, from Indiana, where he met with a sheriff that showed him a gun that was used by John Dillinger, and he was saying what a terrible guy John Dillinger was. Since John Dillinger was in the jail here in Warsaw, Indiana, maybe the director of the FBI was here to check on Tommy. I doubt that.
Been every night worrying about it. I'm particularly worried about the confluence of that virulence among these progeny of Al-Qaeda with Syria. Syria has become the breeding ground, the training ground for thousands of jihadis from around the world, including dozens and dozens from the United States. All of us who know history can draw a line from Afghanistan in the 1980s to 9/11. We are determined not to allow a line from today's Syria to be drawn to future 9/11s. We are determined to anticipate the diaspora of terrorists that's going to happen at some point out of Syria and respond to it aggressively in advance. And as you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, we also face a challenge from these people we call homegrown violent extremists. Some call them lone wolves. I don't like the term. It conveys dignity they don't deserve. But these are people who are not directed by Al-Qaeda, but are inspired and trained, again, through the information available on the Internet, to then emerge from their basement or their bedroom and do something terrible, something we spend a great deal of time worrying about. And domestic terrorism, Mr. Chairman, I think, as the members of this committee know, is something the FBI has long worked. My domestic terrorism operations unit has been busy for the last 20 years. Nothing has changed for us in that regard. It's something we spend a lot of time worrying about and apply resources to make sure we anticipate and address. As I said, we are a national security organization. Counterterrorism is part of that. Counterintelligence is a big part of that. Something we can't talk about in open session because most of that work is done in the shadows. But it is an important part of our work, done extremely well all around the world by my folks. And we are also a law enforcement organization. We're out there every day trying to lock up violent criminals, people who would harm your kids, corrupt public officials, and all manner of bad guys that touch our criminal investigative responsibilities that remain combined with our national security responsibilities in ways that make sense to me. And I'll close just by saying that you and Mr. Conyers have alluded to, lots of folks are asking good questions these days about government power, and that's a great thing. People should be skeptical of government power. I am. I think the country was founded by people who were very skeptical of government power, so they divided it among three branches to balance it. I think it's great that people ask questions. I think one of my jobs is, to the extent I can, to answer those questions. And I hope folks will give me the space and time in American public life to listen to the answers, because there's an angel in the details of my work. There's a reason why it matters that I be able to get lawful process to search and get content of some bad guy who's emailing about a terrorist plot or a criminal enterprise. There's a reason I need to be able to track with lawful process the location through a cell phone of someone who's kidnapped a child or is fleeing from justice. All those things matter a great deal. Those details matter, and I believe those details reflect our government working as it should. Hard for me to find that space and time in the windstorm I live in right now. And last, thank you again on behalf of the people of the FBI.
Boy, he's a fast talker. Yeah, right. He's after the lone wolves, too. Well, anyhow, he's talking about going after corrupt public officials. If he was really going after corrupt public officials, he'd probably be arresting half of the people on the panel that was interviewing him there in Washington. That'll end up sooner or later being discovered to have been totally corrupt. John Conyers from Michigan. Oh, God. You know, I wonder what would happen if hundreds of people went on their Twitter or Twitter or whatever or however you want to do it, and put just send out terrorist plot. Two words, terrorist plot. I think the whole damn security intelligence division would collapse. I mean, you know, they go crazy. I mean, you know, just by having so many people put out terrorist plot. Well, anyhow, we'll see. Well, to be perfectly honest, I have more respect for John Dillinger, a good old Hoosier from Indiana, than I did for J. Edgar Hoover, that's for damn sure. I don't know, you might have heard me argue with Wolf Wall Street at one time about chaos. And I support chaos. And he thought that was not good. Well, I do. During a time like this where the empire is beginning to disintegrate, coming apart at the seams a little bit, chaos is good. Chaos is our friend. If chaos is not our friend, then it's an enemy to be feared, like the movie says. So anyhow, I don't know what you think about it, but chaos and confusion should be advocated, should be promoted, and should be a tactical weapon. For an example, here's something that was on the internet this morning. See what you think about this.
What we want is the partition of the United States and a country for everyone. The partition will take into account the proportion of people of varying ideologies and nationalities who wish for a country for themselves and make the country size based on the proportion of the population centered around where each group is the most popular. The United States will not exist forever. States do not exist forever. They come and they go. It is inevitable. Not even China can claim to have existed forever. Ancient Egypt, especially if it proves to be older than what mainstream historians believe, may come the closest, but can we really say that it's the same country as when it was founded? To what extent is China the same country as it was 100 years ago? Or is the United States the same country as it was in 1900, or 1860, or 1866? The United States is more similar to Canada in 2013 than it is to itself in 1964. And if we consider Canada a different country, how much more so is the United States a different country from what it was in 1964? If we consider Canada a different country today, then we must certainly consider the United States a different country from what it was in 1964. In 1942, 30 of 48 states had anti-race mixing laws. And in 1958, 94% of the population supported these laws. And since the United States was only 85% white at the time, this means that at minimum, half of the non-whites also supported the anti-race mixing laws. Now, if you support anti-race mixing laws today, well, then you are completely out of step with the United States today. If you oppose them, well, then the America you support bears no resemblance to the America that fought and won World War II, that had the Civil War, that had the Revolution from Britain, or even the America of 1958. That is, if you support anti-race mixing laws, then your America is dead, dead, and dead.
No, not quite.
If you oppose anti-race mixing laws, well, then your America is a country that came into being in 1965 at the earliest. Your country does not have a history. I mean, you could say, oh, Constitution, well, that's a different country. It's the same flag, and it's a completely different country. So specifically regarding the United States, that anti-secessionism could exist in any substantial numbers is a very strange thing. And I can only conclude that it is a product of people just not thinking much about it. Legality. This is an amazing argument that secession can't be done because it's illegal. Okay, well, first off, secession from Britain was illegal. Republics breaking off from the USSR was illegal, yet there they are. And I personally believe what Benjamin Franklin meant by a republic, if you can keep it, was that secession was likely and allowed to occur. Keeping the republic meant keeping these states in the Union. However, that is just my opinion. But why does the legality of it ever enter into the discussion? Right? We're talking about the creation of a new state, a new legal order, and your argument against a new legal order is, well, the old legal order says no. Following the secession of the states, which became known as the Confederate States of America, the United States military had several military installations in the CSA, and most of these had their garrisons evacuated. But in Fort Sumter in South Carolina, the garrison was not evacuated, and after a prolonged standoff, CSA troops fired a few cannons, and the 85 men in Fort Sumter surrendered. Now, two of the men were actually killed, but they were killed during a salute of the flag prior to taking it down. None were actually killed in the bombardment. For those who don't know, South Carolina is well within the borders of the CSA. And it was this attack, this Confederate attack.
Well, another thing about that was that there was a relief ship boat coming to pick them up and get them out of there quite a while before it got rough, but for some reason the boat was delayed, and of course then things escalated, and then it went too far. It would have been interesting if that boat had not been delayed and evacuated those Union troops out of there. Of course, they'd have probably figured another way to get the war started, but they wouldn't have got it started there.
Attack on Fort Sumter that was used to justify the invasion of the CSA. That's the formal legal justification. Now, you can say whether this was the real cause or not, or what any of this had to do with slavery, but the cold legality of it is that Lincoln claimed that by firing on troops that had been in South Carolina for 4 months, 4 months after South Carolina had seceded, the Confederate States of America had attacked the United States. This was the formal legal justification for the invasion of the Confederate States of America. One might say that the real issue was slavery, or that the CSA did not deserve its independence because it held slaves, and I am sympathetic to this argument, but this was not the justification for war with the CSA at the outset. Now, was Brazil denied their independence? And is Brazil denied their independence to this very day? After all, Brazil not only held slaves, but they held more slaves than the United States ever did. Economies of scale and prosperity. Now, this is an argument that also astounds me. The argument is that in a big union, the individual states benefit from the economies of scale and free trade access that comes from a large country. Now, the first problem with this is that the argument could be used for a global state from which there's absolutely no escape. There's no possibility of breaking out unless they allow you to. And the second problem is that this is just wrong empirically. Countries like the United Arab Emirates, Singapore, Hong Kong, Denmark, Belgium, Holland, Ireland today, where they adopted more of a free market economic policy, Luxembourg, Switzerland, Austria is about as wealthy as Germany. They're all very prosperous countries, and they benefit from economies of scale just fine. And they contribute more than their share to world science and manage their trade just fine. So this idea of you got to be a big country to be rich is just kind of not quite sure where it comes from. I understand the logic by it, but there's, you need more than just a little theory. You got to actually show that it happens, and it doesn't happen. Okay. Racism. This is a major bugaboo. Now, the first question, of course, is what is racism? What do they mean by racism? Do they mean people making racist jokes? That's probably not what they mean. Okay? They probably mean some sort of racially biased law or some sort of legal injustice upon people based on race. Okay, well, so what racially aggressive policies do the separatists propose, and why would these racist policies be bad? I mean, you could say that they're racist, but that's one thing. And then, well, the next thing is to say why they're bad. If you know anything about the All Nations Party, you know that we support racial separatists of all types. This involves explicitly racial states with various race laws. Now, this isn't the only form of separatism that we support, nor is it the largest or what most people are in the ANP for, but it is the most problematic since people in the United States have this incredible hang-up on race and racism. Now, if you oppose strict immigration policies, for example, if you oppose those immigration policies that say no non-whites in your country, well, what do you think about Israel's immigration policy? Or what do you think about Israel banning marriages between Jews and non-Jews? What do you think about that? Should Israel be invaded and destroyed because of their race laws? What about Japan's immigration policy? Should Japan be invaded and have their sovereignty revoked because they have rather illiberal views on immigration policy? Maybe the secessionist group will one day be aggressive. This is certainly possible, but it doesn't seem very likely. Another word for secession would be escape. It is what weaker parties do to try to escape a tyrannical union. And so to imagine that the racial separatists will do what exactly and try to invade who? If anything, a separatist group, a group that separates from the United States, if the United States remains otherwise intact, the group that has the most to fear are the separatists themselves. So are you saying that we shouldn't let the USSR break up because a reunified Germany might invade Poland again? Is that the logic we're using? And if your great concern is aggression, well, Japan and Germany were aggressive and engaged in explicitly racial wars against their neighbors and did something that the Confederate States of America did not do, which is declare war on other countries, attack them based on racial supremacist ideologies, and the CSA was attacked. So should those countries, Japan and Germany, should they be denied their sovereignty today? Should Japan be incorporated into the United States today out of fear that they might invade Korea again? And if your concern is aggression, well, why do Egypt, Jordan, and Syria still exist after repeated attempts to invade Israel and explicitly saying, we want to drive them into the sea and saying, we want to kill them all, we want to kill all the Jews there? Why is North Korea allowed sovereignty after an aggressive invasion of the south of the country? And while we're at it, why don't we incorporate the United Kingdom and France into the United States, since the United Kingdom and France invaded about half the world, right? Or what about Mongolia? They once ruled about half the world as well, quite a while ago, but don't want those passions flaming up again. Maybe that's not the problem. Maybe the problem is that a separate state from the U.S. will do mean things to certain minorities within their borders. If a new Europe forms in the Pacific Northwest, oh, maybe they'll be mean to black people or something. Maybe, but this is a hypothetical. This isn't proven. It's also possible that the U.S. will do mean things to their minorities right now. More importantly, the crime hasn't been committed. And by denying secession, it would be like saying, well, in the past, the Japanese were quite savage to other ethnicities. And the kinds of people who support Japanese independence from the U.S. could be the same kinds of people who supported race-based oppression in Imperial Japan. So let's force Japan into a union with the United States because they might do it now, even though they have no signs of wanting to do it now. But beyond that, I think the kind of person who opposes secession would have supported the aggressive racial policies in Japan back then. Because the thug and the bully, they tend to be zealous for the status quo, whatever it is. And in the past, they'd be brown shirts. Today, they're screaming about how horrible racism is and that secession should not be allowed because racism. But in the United States, the situation is even more absurd, because all of the race laws in the United States, for example, prohibiting interracial marriage and prohibiting non-European immigration, and before that, outright slavery, okay, all of these laws were expressly supported by the United States federal government at the time. And these race laws were as nothing compared to the race laws in Nazi Germany, Imperial Japan, Brazil, and even India in the 1960s in their caste system. So let's get this straight. Germany, Brazil, India, and Japan are allowed their own countries, despite race laws which were far more extensive than what existed in the CSA, and far more extensive than what existed in the Jim Crow South, even though the race laws in the CSA and later the Jim Crow South were expressly supported by the U.S. federal government at the time. But the CSA must not be allowed independence because of these federal government-endorsed race laws that they held, which were less draconian than the race laws other countries, which are allowed to have sovereignty now, which are less draconian than the laws that they had. There's no consistency here. This doesn't make any sense. There is no logic to anti-secessionism. The reality of secession. When Ukraine seceded from the Soviet Union, did they threaten the sovereignty of Russia? When Slovakia seceded from Czechoslovakia, did Slovakia then go on to become a great enemy of the Czech Republic? When Canada and Australia and New Zealand seceded from Britain, did they go on to threaten Britain? The United States is the only country that really came close to being a threat to the country that it seceded from. But of course, the U.S. is the very country I'm saying should be broken up. For example, when Brazil seceded from Portugal, did Brazil become a mortal enemy of Portugal? In the United States, the group wanting secession has always been the weaker party. It was clearly the weaker party at the time of the United States invasion of the CSA, and those currents which led to the CSA have only gotten relatively weaker. Horror stories about secessionist belligerence go against the lessons of history and are based on absurd hypotheticals that fly in the face of the facts. Let me draw a parallel that may disturb many staunch Americanists. The Soviet Union, in November of 1922, viewed itself as the heir to the Russian Empire, meaning that they were the rightful owners of Poland, the Baltic states, and Finland, along with what they already controlled. One may be confused as to how the USSR could be so heavy-handed against Finland and the Baltic states, and later against Poland. Okay, well, the reason for this was that the USSR saw this as merely a continuation of the Russian Civil War, and considered the countries of Poland and Finland to be just as much a white faction, a loyalist faction, as, say, the UFO Directory, the Archangel Government, or the Volunteers Army. And so the Soviet invasion of Poland, Finland, and the Baltic states can be seen as anti-secession actions. Right? These were territories that had seceded from the Soviet Union during the Civil War and managed to stay out for a while, and the USSR simply saw it as a continuation of the Russian Civil War, preventing their secession. In 1953, the USSR sent in troops to crush anti-Soviet uprisings in Berlin, neo-Nazi uprisings in Berlin. In 1956, Hungary attempted secession from the Soviet Union, and they were similarly crushed. In 1968, Prague attempted secession, also crushed. So based on this history, if you were looking at the situation in the Soviet Union in 1968, based on this history, it would seem that the USSR would never tolerate secession. And yet, in 1991, the USSR disintegrated without a single war or battle. The states began to break off, and the USSR just let them. It was possible that the Soviet military could clamp down and deny secession like they did as recently as 1968, but guess what? They didn't. Moreover, the economic situation of the USSR, while poor in 1991, was certainly better off than it was in, say, 1920, when the Soviets had no problem raising armies and fighting wars and going through all the hardship that a war entailed. But while they were in a better position to do that in 1991, they chose not to. It was a matter of will, not material resources. The ideology was drained. The farce was up. In 1861, the United States didn't allow the Southern Confederation of Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Florida, Tennessee, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia to secede. Now, it's possible that the U.S. wouldn't allow secession today. It's possible. It's also possible that they would, that they would have as much respect for self-determination as the Soviet Union in 1991 did. It's also possible that they would have less respect for self-determination than the Soviet Union did. It's also possible that people in the United States will recognize the farce and the hypocrisy of opposing secession in a country that owes its origins to illegal secession, and just how deranged the creepy cult of the Sacred Union is. Where does anti-secession come from? According to Rasmussen on July 2012, 24% of the people in the United States believe the 50 states have a right to secede, 59% believe they don't, and 17% are undecided. Now, while unscientific, my perusal of forums have found anti-secessionism to be quite common. What on earth do these people think they would be fighting for if they were to fight against secession? The United States? America? What is America? Is it the land? Are they fighting for the land? Don't think anybody would say that. Well, if it's an ideology, well, what is the ideology? Is the U.S. any more free than Canada? If you want to point to the Constitution, well, you're pointing to your interpretation of it. And even that is merely a potential, not something realized, and arguably it was never realized. And if you want your interpretation of the U.S. Constitution realized, well, I fail to see how maintaining a union with people who have very different views helps you realize your goal, unless you're just irredentist bigot. So let's get real. The United States' best days are behind it. American triumphalism is a thing of the past. The debt-to-GDP ratio continues to grow, and neither party is willing to solve it. Neither party will solve it. Okay? Neither party will solve it. The United States cannot pay for the entitlement programs that exist today as of January 2013. Right? As of January 2013, the United States is not paying for these entitlement programs from the taxes it raises. Now, while the bogus unemployment rate in the U.S. may go down, the percentage of the U.S. population aged 18 to 65 which actually has a job has kept falling. In 2006, The labor force participation rate was 63.1%. In 2011, it was down to 58.4%. Which is funny. Like, how can this happen if the unemployment rate keeps falling? Well, the BLS official unemployment rate that you see bandied about in the media so much stops counting people after 6 months unemployed, and it just assumes that those people don't want to work anymore. Funny how more and more people just don't want to work anymore. We can also look at the U.S. debt-to-GDP ratio over time. Right? In 2008, it was 69.5%. The debt was 69.5% of U.S. GDP. In 2012, it was 104.8% of GDP. Right? Growth in an economy comes from investment, and investment depends on savings. People simply aren't willing to invest in the United States. They don't even trust the U.S. Treasury. 80% of all bonds nowadays are bought by the Federal Reserve, which has an infinite checkbook. They can just poof money into existence. Foreigners don't want to buy U.S. debt anymore, and so in a roundabout way, the government is being funded by printing more money, resulting in inflation and, of course, business cycle, right? Banana Republic type stuff. The St. Louis Federal Reserve reports that U.S. banks have $1.6 trillion in excess reserves, up from zero in 2008. Now, what this means is that these are reserves the banks are holding above the legal requirement, and the banks have to pay interest on them, and they have to suffer inflation by holding these reserves, right? So they have to pay money. They basically have to pay to sit on this money. Right? They have to pay interest back to wherever they got these reserves from, and they have to deal with the inflation on that. So they're paying to hold on to this money. And so the banks have decided that it is better to pay interest and suffer from inflation than it is to invest in the United States. That is, they have deduced that the United States isn't just worthless investment, it is worse than worthless. That they will lose money if they choose to invest in the United States. Better to just take the sure losses that they'll take by paying interest on holding this money. If that doesn't count as a vote of no confidence, I don't know what does. Okay. More bad news is that the rate of startups, business startups per million in the United States has also declined. For example, in 1994, it was 2.12 startups per million people in the United States. In 2004, it was 2.08, and it remained pretty stable until 2008. 2008, it was 2.08 startups per million people. 2011, it was down to 1.73 startups per million. Okay. And less and less people are in control of the means of production. In addition, the wealth gap is widening, with the bottom 0 to 50% going from owning 3% of wealth in 1989 to 1.1% in 2010, whereas the top 1% went from owning 30.1% in 1989 to 34.5% in 2010. Now, this is a substantial shift, especially at the very bottom of it. Right. The bottom 50%, their wealth as a percentage of the economy has gone from 3% to 1.1%. So it's basically shrunk to a third of what it was in 1989. Okay, but these trends are continuing. These trends are not stopping. But fear not, despite all the sour information, corporate profits are still higher than ever. We can look at corporate profits as a percentage of GDP. In 2004, they were 7.4%. In 2008, they were 8.2%. And in 2011, corporate profits were 11% of GDP. 11%. 11% of the economy was corporate profits. None of these problems are going to be solved by the U.S. federal government because nobody is going to attempt to solve them. The first thing you need to solve these problems is a nation willing to solve them. And the United States right now is not a nation. Simply not. Now, on this picture here is the proposed partition of the United States by the All Nations Party. The U.S. is to be divided into ideological countries. Though the specifics are subject to substantial revision, I made this map based on polling data and the political geography of the United States and with an eye to contiguity, to not having too much breakup of the countries and their locations. When discussing alternative histories, one way to look at it is that you, right now, are living in an alternative history compared to what could have happened. The United States was not some inevitable thing. In regards to the national debt, I see this done by fobbing it off on each citizen of the United States. Each citizen is given their share of the national debt. And this is necessary because immediately following a partition of the United States, there will be mass expulsions and migrations of people. And so some countries will end up with smaller populations than they started with once this all shakes out. So a debt assignment on the basis of population will work better as the debt will follow the population levels. Now, one may view what I'm talking about, this partition, as pie in the sky, but the plan has to start somewhere. The goal has to start somewhere. Not only has reform so far not worked, but why do you even want reform in the U.S. to work? I fail to see how maintaining the United States as it is, instead of forming a country for people like you, is some great prize. seems like a booby prize. Why save the United States when you can have your own country? Dislocation? Most people move multiple times in their lives. According to the U.S. Census, roughly 6% of the population moves substantially every year, or 14% moves if you include movements within counting. If we assume that 33% of the U.S. population will be forced to move as a result of partition, or will move voluntarily as a result of partition, that will be a lot of movement. But it's less than 5.5 times the annual rate already. And let's not kid ourselves, 5.5 times is a lot more people moving, but it's not inconceivably more. The United States is a fairly mobile country. And if we space out the migration over 5.5 years, then it would only be double the current rate of movement for 5.5 years. And if we space it out over 10 years, well, then the annual movement rate would be 9.3% instead of what it is now, 6%. So it's not that much of a big deal once you consider how much movement has already taken place. Sure, new school, new friends, but all this has been done before, and you know what you're in for. Though in some ways it will be even easier, since so many people will be moving around, it will become this normal thing to have a lot of new people. I recall when my grandmother lived in Illinois and moved to Florida. At first, she didn't want to go because she felt that she had roots in Illinois. Well, having left for Florida, she was shocked at how all of her friends nonchalantly waved her by and how quickly she developed a new social network of equal size in Florida, and one that was actually better since she wasn't maintaining old friendships out of inertia, maintaining friendships with people that she wouldn't befriend now if she just met them today. But before forming a more in-depth policy regarding expulsions, the All Nations Party has three major guidelines in regards to expulsions. One, retirees and people just running out the clock in an area cannot be expelled. Right? Basically dealing with people who are 70-year-old retirees, just want to live out their days on their porch, no expelling them. Two, expelled persons' land property cannot be seized nor eminent domain exercised. And three, people will be given at least 8 years' notice before being expelled from an area marked for a new country. The real issue is economic dislocation. Firms are going to have to incorporate new personnel in their operations, roughly a third, and to the extent that their personnel no longer matches the operations in an area, they will have to move their operations, right? Now, the fear of dislocation is overblown. It looks huge until you actually look at the numbers and what is actually already being done. But for what dislocation there will be, one can think of it as a doctor fixing a broken arm. The first thing the doctor does is break it again so that it can heal properly. A polyglot country doesn't have a uniform interest in solving problems. It has sectarian interests, each trying to get what's best for their ideological or racial group. And this results in a tragedy of the commons and nonsense policies that follows no coherent plan because the country itself is incoherent. It's authoritarian to make people move. If you don't like this plan because forcing people to move is authoritarian, well, that ship has sailed. Public schools and the current tax structures alone represent a far greater intrusion into people's lives than forced emigration does. Right? And forced emigration, that would be a one-time thing anyway. And in terms of the hassle that forced emigration entails, it's nothing compared to the hassle of going through the public school system. And is it any more authoritarian than the wars that the United States gets involved in around the world? Such wars would be rendered impractical as the U.S. becomes divided up like Western Europe is. Now, if you're a libertarian who, even though this plan represents less intrusion than what the U.S. already does right now, you don't want to vote for it because expulsion is still some intrusion in people's lives. Making people move around, well, that's still some intrusion, even though it's less than what the U.S. federal government currently does. Well, I see that as similar to a concentration camp inmate being unwilling to break out because they would have to trample on some guy's pumpkin patch, right, just outside the gate. Okay, please, libertarians, get your heads out of your pumpkins and recognize the All Nations Party as the most realistic way to get what you want. Hopefully, you can have a visceral understanding of the potential future of a partition USA. Okay? Starts off with moving and the whole hassle of moving, the company you work for having some program to maintain employment in a new area, or getting a new job in that area with new friends and a new school for your kids, if you have kids, then realizing that the people you are around are more like you. And then after, say, 3 years, things are starting to get better economically. The dislocation is starting to be worked out. And the general economy is more prosperous, promotions are easier to come by, jobs are easier to come by, and your dollar, or whatever the currency is, seems to go farther. And then you find it easier to get the medical services you need from either a universal health care plan or a free market health care plan, both of which are infinitely superior to this incoherent mess that the U.S. medical situation currently is. If you want to keep America together, ask yourself, what is an American? Is an American a racial type? Right? Do we define an American by their race? I don't think anyone believes this, so I'm just going to say no. By their economic ideology, by their views on economic policy? Well, certainly there is no agreement on economic policy in the United States, so it can't be that. Is it religion? Well, there's overwhelming support for Christianity, but there's also overwhelming support for Christianity in many countries, and they're not Americans, and moreover, there's all sorts of Christian sects in the U.S., and one can be a Muslim and be a citizen of the U.S., so it's not religion. I mean, American is not a theistic religion. Okay, so what is it? What is an American? It's not a racial type. It's not an economic ideology. It's not a theistic religion. So what is an American? And the answer that I've come to is an American is nothing. There is no such thing as an American. There are people who are citizens of the United States, but that's it. It's just a legal title. It's just a legal fruffery is all it is. There is no such thing as an American. There is no such thing as an America, except in terms of the political reality of the United States. That's all. And so if you say, well, I'm fighting for America, it's the United States federal government. It's Obama. It's drones. It's, you know, gun control, which is really civilian disarmament. Okay. It's the national debt. It's all these wars. You want to say it's the Constitution? What Constitution? Your Constitution? Your idea of the Constitution? What, there is no America, is what I'm saying. And the problem is that people believe in America, and they have this sacralization of America with the fathers. How creepy is that? The fathers and the sacred temples and, of course, the sacred texts, right? Every religion has its sacred texts. And, of course, the Age of Miracles, right, back when politicians were all honest and good, right, the fathers, right, that was the Age of Miracles. So they have all these elements. And all these elements create this religion of America, right? You have the little kiddies and their loyalty oath and their triumphalist history. And people who hate each other will get together in a group chant for the national anthem, national, as if there's some sort of nation. But the problem with this cult, this America cult, is that it causes people who should go their separate ways, who should live and let live, who would be much happier and much better off if they broke up the United States and made separate countries, it causes them to choose to stay together because of the America cult. But, of course, they all have different ideas of what is America, and yet they all sacralize it, and they all think they're talking about the same thing because they all have the same flag, is really what it amounts to. Why insist on being chained to people who you hate and who hate you? Why? You have nothing to lose but those chains. You have a country to win. Join the All Nations Party.
Well, that's all she wrote today. That sounded pretty good to me, but we need to talk about it because there's one thing he pretty much left out, and that's human nature. So we'll talk about it some more tomorrow. I hope the audio is all right. I had to put another preamp in the circuit here, but we'll see what happens. If not, I'll re-record it. It's up on YouTube, and we'll go from there. So that's it for today. 14.5, and shut up!